Good evening and welcome to the Dynamic Duo. Now, you'd normally find Jim Fetzer hosting this program on the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett would be hosting on Mondays and Fridays. Today, however, I've been asked to guest host, and my name is Andrew Johnson. And through the marvel of transatlantic communications, I'm talking to you from the UK. Now, many years ago, I set up a website, and I used to get a lot of email about Andrew Johnson, who used to be one of the US presidents, so that's something I have in common with one of your fellow countrymen. Before I introduce my guest for today, I'd like to start by reading out a few things which seem particularly relevant to our discussion. One quotation I recently heard courtesy of our guest tonight is this expression: to acquire knowledge, one must study, but to acquire wisdom, one must observe. And that was stated by Marilyn Vos Savant. I've also had a message sent to me recently when I notified this person I was going to be doing this dynamic duo tonight. And he wrote to me that, what we're going to be talking about is 9/11. And in relation to this sort of issue of 9/11, which has been talked about many times on this program, of course, my contact said to me, when governments try to hoodwink the masses, we must examine all of the evidence available. Only then will the truth emerge. In examining the evidence, we may find things that are incredible, unpalatable, unpleasant, or even fantastical. If the evidence presents them, then we have no right to reject them. Otherwise, we will be making ourselves into the very propagandists that we say we are opposing, lopping away all the bits we don't want to see, and making patterns out of what's left. I have been shocked at the degree to which some in the 9/11 truth movement want their truths cozy and reassuring, rather than real and simply based on evidence. For example, whether there were planes or not, the stark vehemence with which so-called no-planers are attacked suggests that there are those crying out for truth who actually want only reassuring truths. Let's not tie each other up in dogma and limitation. Instead, let's look at the evidence as honestly as we can. If we are truthful, then we can walk 10 feet tall and bulletproof, because we don't have a party line to uphold, just an unfettered desire to discover the truth through evidence. And I think an unfettered desire to discover the truth describes how our guest, Dr. Judy Wood, has tried to approach her study of 9/11. And I'd like to just check that I've got Judy on the line with me now.
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Fantastic, fantastic. I'm very
pleased
that we're speaking tonight. Now, I'd also just like to sort of follow on from that little introduction with something that was also sent to us this week. And it really is about, in relation to looking at the evidence and finding out what seems to be impossible initially, but when you look at the evidence, you actually find that it isn't impossible, and indeed it seems to be what has actually happened. Now, this person said, when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. This person then said, I've had to exclude planes as impossible. All four of them, and this is on 9/11, of course, I've eliminated conventional demolition as being also impossible, because the top of WTC-2 clearly disappears before our very eyes in the videos. Watching a skyscraper vanishing in real time, I'm not entirely surprised that this utterly improbable truth has been investigated in depth by only one researcher, Dr. Judy Wood, in her intensely insightful observations of the vast amount of photographic evidence provided by various authorities. And I think also what I'd like to kind of put into the mix here, obviously Dr. Judy Wood's background has been in the academic establishment for quite a number of years. And one thing that I came across about 5 years ago for the first time was from Eisenhower's speech in February 1961 in his leaving address to the nation. And he said at that time, "Today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields." And then Eisenhower went on to say, "A government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. And for every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers." And Eisenhower then said, "The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, etc., it poses a danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific and technological elite." So really, with those words, which Dr. Judy Wood and I have discussed a little before now, I'd like to go over to Dr. Judy Wood and ask her what really started her on the sort of road to 9/11 research. And I think we've now got the break coming up, so I think what will be easier for us to do is to come back after the break, and we'll get Judy to tell us what her experience has been. And this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling in for Jim Fetzer, and we'll be back after the break. Okay, and we're back now with my guest on the Dynamic Duo, Dr. Judy Wood. You'd normally find Jim Fetzer in the hot seat for the program, but I've been asked to fill in for him, and my name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm in the UK. So I'd like to go back to Dr. Judy Wood. I only just managed to catch her briefly in the first segment, and I was asking her how she first got into doing 9/11 research, and so we shall try and pick up our discussion there.
Well, like everyone, you hear about things happening, and someone turned on the TV in the faculty conference room, and we all went in to look. To me, it didn't look right. Buildings don't unravel like a sweater. And I looked around the room, and everyone was in this trance, just mesmerized by it. And I'm looking like, somebody's put a joke on us. This is the War of the Worlds joke, I decided. And so I went up to my office and called my mother on the telephone, because she lives real near the Pentagon. And that was one way of checking, you know, my theory. If this was a War of the Worlds joke, because if she lives near the Pentagon and the Pentagon is being attacked, shouldn't we have fighter jets overhead? She looks out, no fighter jets. So we both decided that it was a hoax.
Really, that's interesting. I you know, I've not heard you, in the time that we've spoken, I've not heard you tell me that particular interesting story. So what really, you know, what sort of set you going on the path of research?
Yeah, and then after that, I went down to the faculty conference room, but they all looked at me like, what kind of an idiot did we hire? And you get the sense that you're supposed to shut up. While I was up in my office, I did this quick, you know, parallel analogy of billiard balls, which I think most folks have seen now. It's on my website. But I mentally went through this exercise to see what kind of time you would expect the towers to, you know, disintegrate in.
And how long was it after the event that you actually went through that, either that mental exercise or you actually wrote something down? Was it, you know, the day after, or?
Oh, that was right then. After I finished talking with my mom, I went through this, you know, exercise mentally and did some quick calculations. And then I thought, well, maybe I have the wrong value of the coefficient of gravity. So I checked my physics book to make sure I remembered it correctly, because, you know, something's wrong with this picture. And that was correct. Well, maybe that's a typo, and maybe I should check another book. And I think I checked 3 or 4 books.
Wow.
And I felt pretty confident about what I had calculated. Went back to the conference room, and they're still mesmerized. And that's when I got the strong feeling that, you know, we can't talk about this. There's something weird was going on. So I was hoping that somebody else was taking care of it, you know, the grown-ups. Because I wanted to keep my job, and it was very clear that, you know, I was on probation, kind of, you know, new faculty, that you don't want to stick your neck out too far.
Absolutely, and I think this is really, you know, this ties in precisely with what Eisenhower said in terms of much of the research now in universities is, you know, funded by the government at some, you know, level. And this is what is preventing a lot of people from speaking out. And, you know, for yourself, I think you're one of the extremely rare people that's actually, you know, spoken out and done something about it, which we'll be discussing later in the program. I'd also like to add at this point that I'm hoping that Dr. Judy Wood will be with us tomorrow evening, where I will also be hosting the show. So we've got quite a lot to discuss, which we'll be getting to shortly. And I think, Judy, when we mentioned how you became involved in the research, and, you know, you also told me that the election played a
yes.
role in things, and if you'd like to sort of discuss
yes.
that.
Well, when I was thinking that grown-ups were going to take care of it, you know, I'll just do my job and, you know, keep my nose to the grindstone so I can get tenure and all the goodies. And after all, when the 2000 presidential selection went belly up, the Florida vote didn't look like it got counted correctly. Folks said, well, we're going to take care of it by the next election. You know, that kept people from finding the errors in the previous one. Okay, well, they'll do it right next time. Well,
yeah.
On election night and the wee hours of the morning when it the same thing repeated with Ohio as the last time it was with Florida, at that moment I realized that they weren't going to fix it and that somebody had to do something. And it was my job as an American citizen to step out. And especially what got me was, I think it was Edwards said, in the wee hours of the morning, every vote counts and every vote will be counted. And then I think it was by 10 a.m., Kerry is throwing in the towel.
Yes, I mean, I was also following it, not extremely closely, but well enough to be very puzzled by Kerry's reaction in the 2004 election. And he, you know, the way I described it to people was he just rolled over and played dead. You know, it was really strange.
I had the class to go to right after that to teach, and I felt the need to apologize to my students. There's something that our generation failed.
And really? So what did you say to them at that point, if you can remember?
I don't remember exactly, but it was, to me, it didn't matter, you know, it wasn't so much who wins the election. It was, if we're going to have a process where votes get counted, let's count the votes.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, it seems to be that a lot of things, such as the vote counting, have, there's so many things which seem to have been subverted in the last, well, since 9/11, basically. And we'll probably talk a little bit about some of the things which have impinged on what, you know, you've been doing, and how some of those things seem to have been, really changed in character since 9/11. I think probably, you know, the question on one or two people's minds, and I do know you wanted to sort of bring this up early on in the discussion, was, you know, we've known Jim Fetz for quite a long time, and, you know, I'm hosting this program tonight, and believe me, no one is more surprised at being asked to do this than I am. And I think really we might want to just discuss exactly why it seems to have happened this way, you know, and why, you know, I think the last time you were on, when you were on with Morgan Reynolds, I think that was, what, two, three weeks ago? So why there hasn't been an intervening point where you've you know, come on with Jim Fetzer?
My work is about getting the truth out.
Yes.
And about exposing the truth, and if it doesn't come out in any other way, that concerns me.
Mm.
And it seems that when I've been on with Jim Fetzer, folks have referred to it as Wood and Fetzer's research.
Yeah. Well, we hear the music again. Yeah. I think we'll come back to this point after the break. And this is the Dynamic Duo. My name is Andrew Johnson. You'd normally hear Jim Fetzer during the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. And we'll talk again after the break. Good evening, everyone. This is the Dynamic Duo. My name is Andrew Johnson. And I have on the line with me Dr. Judy Wood. And before the break, we were discussing actually why Dr. Wood has decided to come on the Dynamic Duo today to speak with me. And we were talking about the research that she's been doing. So if you could carry on from there, please, Judy.
My interest is in the truth, getting to the truth, regardless of what it means, let the chips fall where they may, and exposing the way I see things, you know, looking at the evidence. And I just want to look at the evidence and not worry about what it concludes, because we need to figure out what happened before you figure out what it means. And it's so easily distorted, and it seems that various folks try to take ownership of my research.
Yes.
To distort it, the meaning of it and where it is going. You know, like on various forums, they refer to Fetzer's and Wood's research. And
yes.
I don't know how Fetzer has anything to do with my research.
Yes, I mean, I've seen this a lot, and of course, what we've both experienced is various messages which have been, you know, I mean, you've got your email address posted on your website, and anyone can use it to contact you, but we've repeatedly seen messages have come through, you know, to you from somebody else. Which is always very strange, you know, when one email address is as easy to use as another. So,
right.
So you know,
and
I think
why
also the
why
point
Fetzer has been invited to present my work, but then it's not presented quite right. He refers to lasers, masers, and plasmoids.
Yes.
I don't think I use any of those words.
No, I mean I've noticed this, that if you go onto your website. You talk about directed energy weapons, and you don't use any of those words.
And my specific definition of directed energy weapons is the most general. It's energy that is directed and is used as a weapon. I don't know the name of this gizmo. That is what I call it. It's energy that's been directed and it's been used as a weapon.
Yes, and I think what we've also seen from various other camps is It's the kind of straw man approach in terms of they will invent a term which, you know, they use to describe your research, which you've never used, and this makes it then, you know, becomes essentially a way of, you know, denigrating your research. You know, I think we know the term that we're both thinking of here.
Correct, space beams.
Space beams or ray beams from space. And people start to band this term about as if you've said it, and you never actually have said this.
And I've never said where the gizmo or components of it were located, or you know, what the serial numbers were, or the manufacturer, or anything about it.
That's right, and I think people seem to, sometimes I think it's just an honest mistake that they get mixed up, but people who are focused on research, not necessarily scientific research, but factual research, should be able to determine the particular, you know, vocabulary that's being used to describe something. And I think we've seen this as a repeated
mm-hmm.
theme where they're just very careless with the vocabulary, and you have to, after a period of time, ask yourself what, you know, why this is true.
Yes, by design. And it's interesting that there are particular words in a list that get used a lot. And it sort of identifies the source. But I have not said what was used. I've eliminated things that could not have done it. Now, I didn't say bubble gum was not involved. I didn't say there was no bubble gum in the building.
Mm.
Just that, you know, bubble gum isn't capable of turning a 500,000-ton building into powder in 8 seconds.
Yes.
And, you know, I've gone down that kind of list. But also have defined different characteristics that I've seen. And what was pretty interesting about this whole path I've taken, I didn't know that such a thing as directed energy weapons existed, but the data told me it did.
This is the point, isn't it, which I think some people miss. And obviously when you posted certain conclusions on your website, then people, you know, try to attack well, I mean, in some cases, you haven't posted actual conclusions. I mean, I've got to be careful what I say here because I've said certain things, you know, which I try and make it clear when they can only be attributed to me, you know, and I'm sometimes guilty of not always making that clear. But nevertheless, you know, I feel so strongly about some of this evidence that you've done such an amazing job collecting and how it's kind of tied in what I've been studying for the last 5 years, that I perhaps sometimes go a little bit too far occasionally. But nevertheless, I think, you know, to go back to the point of evidence, that is really the focus of what we want to talk about primarily, is the evidence for...
And something my favorite question I just have to ask here. Looking at the scene of after the event on 9/11, you have to ask, where'd the buildings go?
Yeah.
And more importantly, why haven't any other people been asking that question?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think that goes right back to how... such are the events of 9/11 have unfolded and the way that the reaction to them has been, it's really, arrested people intellectually.
Yes, and that folks can't observe it. Now, that's not a difficult question to ask. It doesn't take a lot of background. It just takes independent thought. You can't be a trained monkey and then say, where'd the building go? Because that wasn't how our citizens were trained.
Yes.
And they were trained by, you know, all sorts of means. And, you know, if someone had planned 9/11, don't you think they would have planned to cover up with it? You know, they're not going to do something like that without a cover-up. So what would the cover-up look like? It would be leading folks astray away from looking at the data. So let's ignore any other input and just look at the data. And then, boom, you start seeing things.
Absolutely. And really, then it goes back to the evidence and collecting all the evidence and trying to make sense of it. And I've heard it said repeatedly by people that I know, Judy Wood just puts out speculation, which is totally untrue, because what you put on the table is a vast amount of evidence. And I just, you know, wanted to say at this point that, you know, your site that you put together, it's got so much evidence and so much material on there. And really, a lot of it doesn't really need any translation into another language, because it's mainly pictorial in nature. So anybody speaking any language who, you know, looks at these pictures, I mean, it's very easy to see some of what you're saying. For example, as you say, the lack of a building, that's not a technical thing. The building is either there or it isn't. You don't need a technical qualification to identify that.
One of my favorite pictures is of when the people came out of their hiding places right after the second tower went away. Their postures say so much. You know, arms folded, arms at their side. You can see their mouth is gaping open in shock. There was a big building there. Where'd it go?
Yeah.
And there's, you know, paper on the street, but other than that, no other debris. And they're just in shock. Why did folks quit asking that question and quit observing other things? So maybe we could see what else we could observe. Any new observations?
This is the key to unlocking what actually happened, and I think, you know, the study that you've been doing over the last few years has really taken us onto a whole new level with this. You know, and I know we've spoken at length before, and I've said to you that I really, you know, there's so much evidence that you've put on the table which has made me aware of so many things which I wasn't aware of a few years ago, and it's really changed my opinion completely of what happened on that day. And we hear the music again, so we're coming to another break. My name's Andrew Johnson. This is Dynamic Duo. My guest, Dr. Judy Wood, and I'm filling in with Jim Fetzer. And we'll be back after the break. Good evening, everyone. And this is Andrew Johnson filling in for Jim Fetzer, who's normally here in the middle 3 days of the week. And this is the Dynamic Duo. And you would normally find Kevin Barrett here on a Monday and a Friday. Today I'm speaking with my guest, Dr. Judy Wood, about research and study into 9/11. And in a few moments' time, we're going to be looking at her website, which is drjudywood.com. And if you want to follow the discussion, which I strongly recommend, then you can go to a computer and log on there. And so, Judy, you were telling us about the people coming out after the destruction of the buildings, and if you could take us from there, please.
Yeah, well, going back to the faculty conference room and seeing on the TV how the buildings unraveled like a sweater, and then looking at that picture, you wonder, where'd the building go? You're standing looking down an empty street, missing building. And then I began noticing that this dust that settled out fairly quickly started rising up and moving upward. So I wanted to look at it more carefully, study that plume. And I started looking at more and more pictures and gathering as many plume pictures as I could. And then I found one that was pretty startling. It's on the Aaron Index page.
Okay.
DrJudyWood.com/articles/Aaron. It's also listed as the top link for today's show, my listing for that.
Okay.
It's on page 6 of the series, but on the index page, you see this big whitish-looking plume going up into space. But if you look carefully, you see a blackish plume down low to the ground that's going west over the Hudson. So we have segregation of plume.
I see this as figure 11 and 12 on page 6 of the series. Is that correct, Judy?
Okay, I'm getting there. I was on the...
on the index page.
Yeah. So,
there's several pages
I'm
in this series. There's about 7 or 8 pages currently. And it's still, you know, you're basically trying to add more as you find more. Am I correct?
I'm putting more information up there, and people can think what they want of the information.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very striking what... what comes together here. It's down figure 11 and 12. And if you look at the blow-up of that, especially if you click on 12, it jumps out on a separate screen, you see down right, you know, just above ground level, you have this blackish plume going westward over the Hudson, where the whiter-looking stuff is going south and upward. South is sort of towards the lower part of the picture. So why do you have two different color plumes? A different mechanism?
Very strange.
Yeah, you know, the wind's going one direction at the same time. And the white stuff looks very focused. It's on a mission. It's going up and out. So I wanted to study this more carefully, and I then went to look at some satellite images to get more plume pictures. And that's when I found this picture that's at the top of this page. This is huge hurricane. Now, what is this hurricane doing right outside of New York City on 9/11?
Absolutely. And I know that you recently, or fairly recently, did a talk in Seattle where you presented this information, and I've also spoken about it briefly in a talk that I gave last week, and I think, you know, we can both agree that almost nobody had heard of this hurricane.
Correct. There were gasps around the room when I, you know, came to the point of showing this hurricane. I present it the same way. It's like I'm studying the dust. This is chronologically how it occurred. And then I look for some satellite images. And lo and behold, is this huge hurricane. And if you look at the actual square mileage of it on 9/11, it's larger than Katrina was. And it covers more surface area. The day before, it was tighter and faster, and it's like a figure skater that put their arms out and, you know, slowed down a little bit and just stopped. It stopped at that place right outside of New York City, stayed there from 8 a.m. till mid-afternoon, and then turned around, made a U-turn, and started heading back east, out of town. Like it was there for a job, and then it left.
It's very strange, and I think, you know, dwelling on that for a moment, I think it's...
It sums up a whole lot of things. What I see it sums up is weather control, media complicity, and not just foreknowledge, but foreplanning.
Yes.
And here's how. If, you know, obviously the Weather Service is aware of this. Now, if they couldn't control hurricanes, aren't they going to be telling people in New York, you've got this huge hurricane coming this way that might indeed, you know, have, you know, if nothing else, a large storm surge which would submerge Manhattan? You better evacuate. And if they had shown this on the morning news, people wouldn't be watching the show at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock. They'd be packing up and evacuating. So there's a reason why you shouldn't show the public this if you want them to watch TV and watch this other show you have in store. Now, that is a speculation, but I can't think of any other reason why they would not notify the public there's this huge hurricane right outside of town. There was also an International Space Station flight right overhead at about that time. And Frank Culberson, is that his name?
That's his name.
Took a video of it, and he had to zoom in to take a video of New York City and not get the hurricane in the picture. He'd be very careful to aim right between, you know, flat in the clouds. And then he said, I'm looking up and down the East Coast to see if I see anything else. Nope, don't see anything.
I remember this clip well because I've played it several times, and it is somewhat staggering to consider that they would have ignored such a sight. You know, particularly, I think you've got the pictures on Erin 1.
As well as that video.
Yeah, so Judy's collected the video clip on the Erin 1 page. Is there anything more you wanted to add to that? I mean, I was thinking of going on to talk about the actual path before 9/11 as well. You know, you've already mentioned.
Yes, we should go to Erin 1, that page. And if folks say, as long as you're in the Erin series, at the very top or very bottom, there's a menu that you can get to any of the other Erin pages from within there. So if you go to Erin 1, you can see various reports of what the path was.
Okay, and I'm looking particularly at Figure 2A. We found a number of different sources for the path. I believe you've got one on that page. I'm just having a look myself to check where it is.
Well, on that page, let me point out Figure 3A and 3B. Those are screens, I'm told, of the weather that morning, the weather report, around 7 a.m. or so. The forecast for the day, and they show that area of the ocean where you should see this big pinwheel out there. There's no mention of the hurricane, and it should be in the picture.
And the only thing we've got as an indication on there is rough seas in the Figure 3A.
Yeah, rough seas. They don't say why you have rough seas.
So, you know, it really does look as if the media was complicit in covering up this the knowledge of this hurricane. And, you know, what I wanted to say about the path, particularly, you know, which ties into what you were saying a couple of minutes ago, was we see it past Bermuda, and I think you'd mentioned to me that you'd collected some CNN reports that the CNN basically said, oh, well, you know, the hurricane has gone past Bermuda, and it's now going out to sea, and, you know, we're not really worried about it.
Yeah, it's headed northwest from Bermuda, headed out to sea. But, wait, northwest of Bermuda is not out to sea. It's straight to New York.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, this really, to me, is staggering for any number of reasons that, you know, she already touched on. And now we have another commercial break coming up. And so this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling for Jim Fetzer. And my guest is Dr. Judy Wood, and we'll be back after the break. Good evening, this is the Dynamic Duo, and my name is Andrew Johnson. And I am speaking with Dr. Judy Wood about topics related to 9/11, some very important topics, I might add. Now, while the break was going there, I got a note that we have a caller on the line, and I believe it's Bill from Atlanta. And I think we'll go to Bill first and see what he's got to ask us or tell us.
Hello.
Hello, is that Bill?
Yeah, this is me.
Hi.
I'm really taken aback by the scientific and engineering community in that they haven't really accepted that I can see and I may be unaware of a lot of things, the evidence that Dr. Wood has presented, and I think that, I mean, I have some training in science and engineering, and I want to note her careful exposition of the evidence and her restraint in jumping to conclusions. I'm very much impressed by her work, and I want to make this one other point that accepting that extraordinary weapons and video fakery were used, and this is just a possibility, would implicate the military media complex, whereas the simple thermite theory, even if that included the planting of C4 explosives, wouldn't necessarily do that. So I'll get off.
Well, thank you very much for that contribution. I don't know whether Judy would like to say anything in response there.
Thank you. We need more people like this who open her eyes and say, yeah, where did the building go?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Thank you
for the great program, Dr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, sorry. Yes, and I think, you know, one of the points I was just going to briefly make there before we go back to the study of the hurricane on 9/11 is that it's very easy to let other people do your thinking for you, and I think the power of Dr. Wood's website is that basically it's really a set of evidence with just some brief comments to really only delineate one piece of evidence from the other, and there's not a lot of speculation. There's no speculation, and this is really one of the keys to what we're trying to explain with everything that we're covering tonight, and hopefully tomorrow night as well. So if we could now go back to where we got to, and I believe before the break we were talking about the path of Hurricane Erin.
Well, let me say one thing about speculation. There is some speculation. My speculation consists of, do you think after 1945 they stopped all research into weapon development? And was it 1945 was when they discovered microwave ovens, or microwave, and mid-50s, lasers. So let's extrapolate from there. Do you think there's been more developments? I don't think there's a whole lot of speculation involved there. It's you pretty much anticipate that something's going on. Just why do they have a secret weapons program?
Of course, I mean, we know that there are secret weapons programs, and there are things called Special Access Projects, SAPs, and USAPs, which are unacknowledged special access projects, and the black budget is said to be up to $1 trillion per year once you take all the source of funds into account. And as Eisenhower said in the earlier part of his speech, you know, we have to be aware of what the military-industrial complex can do. And I think what we're seeing, however bizarre it may look, is some of the results of that. And I think what, you know, I don't know if you wanted to add anything more, Judy, before we just sort of go back to the path of Erin.
Yeah.
We'll carry on with that.
Well, we were on Erin 1 on that page, and there's some other, you know, images of hurricanes from space, and it's hard to miss. There's one where in Figure 8 where the space station is passing over Hurricane Ivan. And it's this huge monster. It looks like a big drain. I'm about to suck them up. It's just a huge pattern. And, you know, they have to have noticed it. Why was it discussed?
Exactly. And I think for those listening, if they watch the video clip, you know, they will see the camera zoom in on New York City. The picture taken on 9/11 from the space station, and it is very peculiar how they don't mention this hurricane.
There was also a blanked out portion of the text in there, the speech, and that's right, you know, good analysis or something like that. And the Johnson Space Center says, but it was blanked out before then what they'd said.
Yes.
So it was censored. And if I were in the space station then and had known about what happened in 9/11, I would say, well, thank God the hurricane didn't hit them. You know, imagine what that, you know, that would be an extra bad problem. And also, flying around a hurricane, someone had pointed out that there was a testimony by Mark Dayton to the 9/11 Commission saying that the planes were 150 miles east out over the Atlantic. Well, that would put them right in the middle of the hurricane.
Both those are very good points, Judy, and I have not thought of either of those.
It's a big mess there. So if we go to Aaron 2.
Okay.
For that to load, there's I show more pictures of the hurricane and zooming in down below and what was there. And one thing you start noticing about the hurricane, you know, what things happen with hurricanes? What do we associate with hurricanes?
Exactly.
A lot of destruction. Well, I think you mentioned the path of it went right past Bermuda. Would you know that as it was approaching Bermuda, it was going from a tropical storm up to a hurricane status? And it cranked up to a Category 3. While it was doing that, they downgraded it to a tropical storm.
Yes, I mean, if you look at some of the reports, I believe, you know, you can sort of conclude that they were trying to play it down, what the hurricane was actually going to do. As soon as it had passed Bermuda, around the time it was passing Bermuda, you know, you could see that they were trying to sort of basically say it wasn't going to be as bad as, you know, what it looked like. And I don't know if you want to sort of point out any salient features of the table of figures you've got there, Judy. You've got quite a lot of figures.
Yeah, there's the table that from the National Hurricane Center of the various values at various coordinates. And from that, you can tell that it was closest to New York City on the morning of 9/11, around 8 a.m. And then it just stopped. It didn't keep going east or west. It just stopped. And then it turned around and started heading back out. But one thing that I found so interesting is the study of Hurricane Aaron. The study began August 16th, and it went through September 24th. I'll read from one of the reports. The mission originated from the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida. The mission united researchers from 10 universities, 5 NASA centers, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they studied this hurricane from August 16th to August 24th. But wait a minute, the hurricane didn't even exist until the 1st of September. So they started studying this hurricane 2 weeks before it was born.
It really does make you wonder. I mean, we've heard the phrase inside information, but it seems incredible to suggest that somebody could have inside information as to when the hurricane, you know, would appear. Now, I suppose one, you know, plain devil's advocate might argue that they knew that at a certain calendar date the hurricane season was due to start, so they just hung around until, you know, appeared. But I think, again, we've got music coming for the commercial break.
Okay.
So we'll try and pick this up with my guest, Dr. Judy Wood, after the break. This is Andrew Johnson filling in for Jim Fetcher on the Dynamic Duo. And we'll be back after the break. Good evening. I'm talking to you, getting my words mixed already. This is the Dynamic Duo, and my name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm filling in for Jim Fetcher, who's normally here in the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett is here on Mondays and Fridays. And I'm speaking with Dr. Judy Wood about 9/11 and the hurricane, which was out in the Atlantic Ocean and closest to New York City on 9/11, and what relevance that has to all of us. And we've been discussing how this hurricane was studied by a team of scientists. So if you'd like to pick up from there, please, Judy.
I think even the article, it talks about unprecedented data collection. Yeah, this was studied more than any other hurricane to date, and there's a lot of people who are involved in studying it, and I would like to reach out to those people and point out that I have a whistleblower page where they can send information to me anonymously or can leave me contact information to contact them. But the people who worked on that, I assume, do not realize the connection and what they were working on, because there's so much compartmentalization. And to have such a big thing as this, this is kind of shocking. You know, they have to wonder themselves why folks were not alerted to a hurricane right outside of New York. It was raining on Long Island, raining on Cape Cod on 9/11. And we remember seeing this beautiful, clear day. It was just clear right in that one spot. I would like to move on and talk about on Aaron 3, page 3. What do hurricanes do? So why would they want a hurricane there? And I started looking at the similarities between hurricanes and tornadoes. And we think of, you know, cars getting picked up in tornadoes or hurricanes, and everyone talks about, you know, straw being blown through a tree. Well, I looked at that more carefully, and it's rather shocking as to what I learned. So at the top of this page, I have several pictures. One is interesting, is figure 4. It's a tornado with a lightning bolt going down, as though there's a potential between the upper cloud and the ground. And I think all of us can recall how we feel when a storm is approaching. You feel it coming. Why do we feel it? We feel it because it produces field effects, some kind of energy field that is surrounding that weather pattern, whether it's a hurricane or a tornado or whatever. And I've seen videos and studied them, how some of these tornadoes come from the ground up. They don't come from the top down. It seems to be the effect of some potential. And if we look further down the page, I have the section I call stab wounds, where from Hurricane Andrew, you know, Andrew was here, paint on somebody's roof. We have two befores through palm trees, plywood through palm tree, straw in trees. Now, how does a wimpy piece of straw go through a tree? Well, the old wives' tale, or the theory, is that the tree bends over and a crack opens up and the straw sticks in and the tree rights itself and the straw gets pinched in there. But I found this Russian article, I think it's dated 1997 or somewhere, you know, a while back, that actually has the mathematical formulas for this. As to
this
what,
is figure 13, is that correct, Judy?
Figure 13, and the article is down below. About this, but if you just start though looking at the various characteristics, like this figure 16, you have this car sitting on a fence.
This is an extraordinary picture.
How'd the car get there? And this spring, May 10th, there was a hurricane, tornadoes in the Midwest, and it was a quote that was in lots of newspapers. It said the guy said, I swore I could see cars floating. You know, could this be a form of levitation? And you see isolated events, like one car flipped over, but the ones to the left and to the right are just fine. So you wouldn't think it's a big gust of wind, because that would affect cars on either side. And these cars that are sitting on top of another don't look like they've been tumbling. They're not, you know, most cases they're not very scratched up or damaged at all.
It seems to be very selective, doesn't it? And, you know, I think we're going to go on at some point soon, if we don't get time today, then tomorrow, to talk about the common elements here with the what happened at the World Trade Center, which, of course, people might think we've digressed into some, you know, strange area, but actually we haven't. And we've seen these pictures of you know, inverted cars at the World Trade Center.
Right. Flip cars at the World Trade Center, and you have flip cars with tornadoes, I mean hurricanes, and you have a hurricane right outside of New York City on 9/11.
And I think, really, I'd just like to make the point about this. People may be wondering, well, why are we talking about hurricanes in this regard? And Judy mentioned the lightning bolt on one of the pictures of a tornado and this idea of field effects. Well, my understanding, I'm not an expert on weather, but my understanding is that it's said that the power source of hurricanes is convection currents from the ocean, and heat is drawn from the ocean to power the hurricane. And really, the electrical characteristics of the storm are really not talked about very much, other than, you know, the traditional sort of idea that you get lightning associated with them in some way. But as Judy's pointed out, you know, I'm pretty convinced that there's a field effect. There must be a field effect associated with hurricanes, and that's what's causing some of these effects that Judy has just described. And I mean, this is the title of the subtype of this series: field effects and Hurricane Erin.
And there's so we see, you know, just looking at the evidence, not what we're told that we're supposed to see, but if we actually look at it, we see, yeah, flip cars from hurricanes. And they didn't blow anywhere. They're you know, just upside down.
Yes, absolutely. And
further
really
down the page, there's places where material's just missing. You know, the wall's gone off of a building. There's no stab wounds in the building.
Very peculiar, isn't it? A very peculiar set of evidence now that you've collected here for people to really get into and examine and draw their own conclusions. That's really the objective of what, you know, we're trying to get people to do.
Yeah, I ask, how did we get to where we are? It's by giving someone else the power over our opinions.
Yes.
And if we, you know, don't think for ourselves, we'll lose that ability to choose for ourselves.
Yes, yes. Okay, well, we've got the music coming up again, and I'm just at this point going to thank Judy Wood so much for the stuff so far, but we've got another segment, a couple of segments to go, and this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling in for Jim Fetzer, and we'll be back after the break. Good evening, this is Andrew Johnson filling in for Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo, and I'm speaking with Dr. Judy Wood about 9/11, and specifically the study, or her study, of Hurricane Erin on 9/11. And we were looking at some of the field effects associated with hurricanes, which are not talked about very much and are something that Judy has documented in her latest study. And we're on a page called Erin 3, which is at drjudywood.com. And if you could take us from there, please, Judy.
Yes, midway down the page, or about two-thirds way down the page, there's a section called Hurricane Architecture. And,
okay,
you know, above there is some videos you can watch of some interesting tornadoes, how they act. But it's apparently quite known that you have this activity. There's a stem swirling round and round, and then you have this plate at the top. And supercells are formed kind of the same way. Tornadoes and hurricanes have an awful lot in common. You know, one's over land, one's over water. And there's, you know, you start thinking about it, doesn't it look like a bunch of, you know, coils wrapped around? The stem of the hurricane that around the eye has an awful lot of electrical energy in it. That's been established. It creates thunder and lightning. But if you have moisture in the cloud, moisture is conductive. So if you wrap a wire around round circles, you have a coil. And then you have this moving, spinning thing around the top. I think everyone knows that hurricanes spin around. It looks like a big Tesla coil.
I think, you know, I could perhaps make an analogy. I don't know if this is correct, but perhaps the water vapor is like the wire because it conducts, or it has a level of conductance, and the air is like the insulator.
Right, right. And it goes round and round. And if we look at page 4, Erin 4.
Okay, I'll just load that up.
We see some more of these storm pictures, and then I show pictures of Tesla coils. And you can see the similarity.
Absolutely. You can see basically we have, you know, a large area at the top and a stem and you know, the charge on the Tesla coil, I understand, builds up on the top, and we have the central column as, you know, as a coil.
And the strike ring, you know, down below, and there's a picture of Figure 5 of a tornado with lightning bolt actually going down. And I think we all know that with hurricanes and tornadoes, we have lightning bolts. And on 9/11, folks would be surprised to learn this, there were there's reports of thunder at most of the airports right around Ground Zero, JFK Airport, LaGuardia, the one in Newark, as well as the smaller ones out on Long Island. I'm working on a new page where I have those listed. Maybe we can cover that tomorrow.
Okay, that'd
but
be
there's
very
rain
interesting.
And thunder reported at, you know, JFK. That's you know, right close by. So we have these you know, the storm is acting like a big coil.
Exactly, and yeah, I think. You know, there's a couple of things which I'd like to get to. The first point I think we want to make, or I'd want to make, is that you know, we've already spoken before about the Hutchinson effect, which we'll, I think we'll probably do a recap on that at a later point. But basically, the Hutchinson effect started with a set of experiments, which was with Tesla coils. So we're seeing this commonality here. In the idea that the storm has an electrical discharge and a charge separation, which is exactly what you get with a Tesla coil.
Correct. And we also know that from electrical coil, we can make a magnet. And from a magnet, we can make electricity. You can go either way with that.
That's right, and I mean, if you take a magnet and you move it around inside a coil, it will generate an electric current. It's called you know, through a process of inducing an electric current in the coil inductance, and vice versa. If you put an electric current through a wire, it will generate a magnetic field around it.
Right, and if you look at Figure 9A and 9B, one's electromagnetic induction, and then you have electromagnetism. That's which way you're going. So they can switch back and forth, you know, depending on which way it's going. So they're related. And if we start, you know, further down the page, some comparison with the Hutchinson effect, but perhaps we might go to page 5, Aaron 5, at this point.
Yes, and this is perhaps, I think, the most interesting page of all. And I, you know, I would say... arguably the most important data, some of, perhaps if not some of the most important data that you've managed to collect. And I found this pretty astounding, really. So, yes, if you'd like to go take us through this, please, Judy.
And this one deserves a lot of time. If we start at the top, there's a picture, figure 2. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different measurement points, but the only 6 of them were working that day, of where they record the Earth's magnetic field. They have magnetometer data they've collected. And I'd like to point out in this first table timing for various events. WTC1 got its hole at 8:46 in the morning. WTC2 got its hole at 9:02. WTC2 goes poof a minute before 10. WTC1 goes poof about 10:30. And at 5:20 in the afternoon, WTC7 goes poof. And if we look at those particular times on the chart of magnetic data, we can see a blip in the chart for each one of those events. We can see a change in the chart happening coincidentally at that moment. And how far away is Alaska from New York City?
Well, I measured it on you know, map that I've got, and it's about 3,500 miles.
That's pretty big distance.
Yeah, that's in a straight line.
It's like, you know, bigger than the width of the United States, and then some. And if you look at the charts, right, it's figure 16, 17, and 18. They're not numbered correctly yet. The yellow charts,
okay.
There's the up and down magnetic field, the east and west magnetic field, and then the out-of-plane.
Yeah, so if you just explain that a little bit, there's components of the magnetic field which act in a north-south direction. And
magnetic north, yeah.
Yeah, and a component which will act east-west, and then a component which acts into the ground and out of the ground.
Correct. And if we look at these charts, it's for several days leading up to 9/11, not much activity. It wanders around, there's some noise here and there. And then just before the North Tower gets its hole, you see the curves start to diverge, and then they take an abrupt turn right at 8:46 a.m. and start back the other way. So how'd the Earth's magnetic field know that something was going to happen to the towers and anticipate it? That's sarcasm.
This is it, and this is a very, very interesting point of data, and it's one, you know, when I think when we first discussed this a good few weeks ago, you know, I noticed the dip which appeared when the first hole appeared on the building, but this, I didn't really notice this dipping beforehand. And again, we have the music coming up here, so I'm just going to say this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling in for Jim Fetzer, who's here on the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett's here on Monday and Friday. My guest is Dr. Judy Wood, and we will be speaking some more about this very important data after the break. Good evening, this is the Dynamic Duo, and my name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm speaking with Dr. Judy Wood, who's my guest for today, and she'll be speaking with me again tomorrow at the same time. Normally you would find Jim Fetzer here, but these two nights I'm filling in for him, and on Friday and Monday you'll find Professor Kevin Barrett, and we're talking about 9/11 and Hurricane Erin and some of the most important data that Dr. Wood, I think, has gathered. And if she could continue where she left off with the magnetometer data from Alaska. And there are some very important features of this data.
I'll try to get the figure numbers renumbered correctly by tomorrow. I'm still building this page. But the yellow charts are the furthest zoomed out, and it covers 4 days span. And you'll notice that all three measurements are pretty still. There's a little bit of noise here and there. Little things happen right up until just before the North Tower got its hole.
And we're on Erin 5 on drjudywood.com. And which figure is it again, please, Judy?
It's figure 18, the third yellow one, it shows. But if you scroll down further, you get more zoomed-in looks. And you can also click on the diagrams, and a bigger one will jump out. If you go down to there's a blue set, then there's the pink set, then there's a purple set.
Okay.
The purple set is the most zoomed-in.
Okay.
Next to the green set on the right. And between those two, you can see that first blue line, that vertical blue line, that's when the North Tower got its hole. So you see a change in the magnetometer values leading right up to that moment. And especially in the H set, that's figure 10, H5 and H4. That's the purple and green pictures.
Okay.
You see an abrupt change, a kink in the curve, right precisely at the time they say the North Tower got its hole.
And this of course, means that something was going on before the tower
got its hole.
Got its hole. This is the really significant thing, which is easy to miss. Something was affecting the Earth's magnetic field just before the tower got its hole. So, you know, you have to ask the question, if you are going to be curious and you want to look for more evidence, what caused the change in the magnetic field? Now, I'll just, you know, point out that we've already mentioned previously the Hutchinson effect, and one of the things which, you know, we perhaps haven't covered so well is that this idea of the environment having to be charged up before the effects take place. So my, you know, my view on this would be that that is the process that, you know, you are seeing with this dip in the field.
Right. The magnetic field is changing. And maybe things get in equilibrium later, or maybe they don't. And other aspects we can talk more about tomorrow and give folks time to look it over carefully between now and tomorrow, that from the time that the first tower got its hole until Building 7 went poof, things were in disarray, and then they changed at the moment Building 7 went poof, as though that was intended to bring things to an equilibrium. But it didn't quite do that.
And there was something very interesting that you, you know, it's kind of obvious, but when you described it to me, you know, a few days ago, I thought it was very interesting in terms of the mode or the direction of destruction of the towers and also the direction of the crashes or supposed crashes.
Right. We have a hole that appeared in the North Tower going north to south, then a hole in the South Tower that went south to north. Two towers went from top to bottom. Then we have one tower that went from bottom to top.
Yeah, so, you know, there is this kind of weird reversal of directions, you know, associated with the events. Now, of course, we don't know whether that's significant or not. All we can do is note it as a point of data and try and correlate it with other data that, you know, you've been collecting.
Right, that's all we can do is just keep looking and keep your eyes open and keep thinking. But patterns like this seem, you know, to me really strange. What a coincidence that the Earth's magnetic field did something strange right before the towers got their hole, right while they're going poof. I don't say collapse, I say go poof, and they turn to dust, they turn to powder in a relatively short amount of time. We don't know if this is a cause or an effect or totally unrelated coincidence. I think that's pretty far-fetched, especially seeing that they didn't want folks to know about the hurricane and didn't advertise it, that it was in town. But there really appears to be a correlation, that especially that first hole in the North Tower, that V-shaped cusp right at that moment.
It really is very difficult to imagine what else would cause that. I mean, you know, I think it was one of our friends, he pointed out, you know, does a plane crash change the Earth's magnetic field 3,500 miles away? I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary to think of.
Correct. It's, you know, do car crashes cause a change like that in the magnetic field? Do other plane crashes? You know, so, I haven't seen a plane crash that does that.
I think, you know, it's becoming very clear to me, Judy, from the data that you've collected so carefully over the last few years, that, you know, we're getting a better idea and understanding of, you know, what actually happened at the World Trade Center complex. And really, you know, for people to continue to talk about, you know, it solely being the result of explosives or thermite or this, you know, type of thing, it really doesn't. It explains probably less than 1% of the actual data that you've collected, you know, and I'm really feeling now that we're building up towards something here with this whole set of data that you've built up.
Like the parking problem, the cars who accidentally parked upside down.
Well, this is it, and, you know, and some people have said to me, well, a lot of this is all based on very, you know, detailed science, and you have to understand physics. And I've had people say this to me when I've talked about this. And, of course, you know, some of the things that we've spoken about tonight, yes, well, maybe, you know, that's true. But, you know, as I've said, there's no one that I've encountered so far who has difficulty with understanding that what the correct orientation of a car is.
Or that the building's gone.
And that's another one. You know, we can pick on a number of points of data like this, and you know, really, this is the research challenge, if you will, that people have to explain this data in some other way. If it isn't to do with field effects, if it isn't to do with the Hutchinson effect, if it isn't to do with you know, this unusual idea of levitation of materials and objects, then what is it to do with? If somebody has got a good, you know, correlation with the data, then let's hear it. Let's hear it. And I think probably at some point we're going to talk about some of the sort of opposite aspect of that, in that what we're not hearing anyone trying to explain this data. All we're really hearing is a lot of noise, basically, about various topics which are largely unrelated to any evidence.
Or saying that Judy Wood is stupid, or or
exactly.
Judy Wood is a shill, or that doesn't address the data.
Exactly, and this is really, you know, and I mean, I've just been amazed that you continue to find more aspects of this. And I think going, if you'd like to take us down, you've got some further down this same page. You've got a, I think we've got a few minutes left here, probably about 3 minutes left. So we might have to cut this off. And I'll just say at this point, we will be continuing tomorrow with this. So the topics that we haven't covered today, we'll probably do a quick recap tomorrow and then continue. But if we go lower down this page, Jude, I don't know if you can just mention some of the charts you've got there with the very spiky looking charts, and what this was relevant to.
Oh, the ones way down at the bottom, got magnetometer readings, general ones from various hurricane seasons. And just looking at what happens with hurricanes. And you notice, you can tell, looking down the list, they're chronologically ordered, top to bottom, you can see when the hurricane season starts, the values start roaming around the page.
Yeah, so if you go down to about figure 37. Well, here I hear the music, so we've run out of time. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. I'd like to thank Judy very much indeed for coming on tonight. And I'd also like to thank everyone for listening. And we'll speak with you again tomorrow.